Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
The ill-fated Hindenburg, on her last flight, sails over New York. Over Newark's famous auto skyway, the airship was hailed by thousands who little dreamed it was their final glimpse of the Hindenburg. Approaching Lakehurst, the Hindenburg appeared a conquering giant of the skies, but she proved a puny plaything in the mighty grip of fate. It almost seemed as if fate had set the stage for the horrible tragedy. A graceful craft sailing serenely to her doom.
The most famous blimp disaster in the world, the Hindenburg, went down in New Jersey in 1937. Well, there's a new blimp kerfuffle playing out now. A Pentagon program to build national security blimps has cost $2.7 billion, and there's not much to show for it. More on that in a moment. But first, the hemisphere's longest-running guerrilla war may be coming to an end soon. After more than 50 years of fighting, the FARC may be coming in from the cold. The Colombian Marxist guerrilla group has been in peace talks with the government there for 3 years. And the talks have been taking place in Havana, Cuba, where Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos announced a breakthrough in negotiations yesterday. Juan Ferrero is South America Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. He's based in Bogota. Welcome to the program, Juan.
Good to be here. Nice to talk to you.
Great to have you. Well, as I said, the government and the FARC have been in these negotiations for a long time, for about 3 years. What is in this agreement?
Well, this agreement is, this isn't the final agreement. This is one of the biggest obstacles in the agenda that they had set out that governed the talks. The talks began, as you said, 3 years ago. And before those talks began, the two sides had come up with a working plan on certain subjects that they were going to deal with one by one, leading eventually to a peace accord. And this is the fourth of five major points. And this was the most difficult one, because what they were basically negotiating here was what kind of justice would there be for the belligerents in the conflict here. These days, I mean, in today's world, you can't simply amnesty people as they have in many conflicts around the world, Northern Ireland, South Africa, Argentina, many other places, where, you know, generals and other people who committed crimes were simply amnestied and went on with their lives. You can't do that anymore because of Colombia's international commitments, the Rome Statute, many other things like that. And so they had to come up with some kind of plan that would be feasible, that would be something practical enough that the FARC would agree to it, because the FARC, the guerrilla group, is not defeated, and something that would also placate Colombians who, polls show, revile the FARC rebel group.
So this would be punishment for the military as well as the FARC rebels?
Yeah, there's a lot of details that we do not know about, but that is correct. I mean, we're talking about all belligerents in the conflict here. And what they're going to do, what we do know, is that they're going to create some special tribunals. They're going to be made up of Colombian jurists and also some foreign jurists. There's also going to be a truth commission here. But crimes are going to be investigated. There's going to be prosecutions. And there is going to be, what they call, restrictions on liberty. I don't think that we're going to be seeing people going to jail here, prisons as we know them. There's going to be some other avenues created for people who are convicted. But if the FARC participate, I mean, belligerents, not just them, but others participate, give out information, honestly talk about the crimes they committed, and then quote-unquote repair the victims, meaning compensate the victims, then they can take part in this alternative justice system, which, you know, will not mean, as I mentioned, jail time, but it could mean some other kind of restrictions on them that are as yet undefined.
So these reparations for victims, these are victims who were kidnapped or who lost their land,
we're talking basically about people, families who had relatives who were killed, people who were kidnapped. There's cases of rape, used as a tool of war, people displaced from their farms, that kind of thing. very serious crimes.
So I understand Human Rights Watch is not pleased with this agreement.
They're not, and I want to talk to them about it. But, yeah, at this point, they said, you know, this creates a system whereby, you know, people who are convicted of these crimes will never see jail. And so they want to see, you know, some kind of punishment. They say that this is not going to be upheld by the International Criminal Court in The Hague, let alone, you know, Colombia's Constitutional Court, which will have to rule on this at some point. But there are other voices out there. We know, for instance, that Moreno Ocampo, who was the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, has praised this process. And there are others who have also. You know, whether you like it or not, what Colombia is doing is different from what has been seen in other countries in conflict that are trying to resolve their violence.
And was this seen as really the only way to end this, to get the FARC to agree to end this after 50 years of conflict?
Well, I think there's debate on that, too. Certainly people here in Colombia who are opposed to the conflict think that the government had the upper hand and should have simply destroyed the FARC, you know, on the battlefield. And the FARC has been severely weakened over the last decade, no doubt. But others are saying that, you know, that would have taken a lot longer. It would have been bloodier. It would have, you know, what we needed to do in this world, you know, what you want to do is also negotiate. And let's negotiate, try to bring this country together. I will also, you know, point out that, you know, while this is a conflict that's been going on for 51 years, I mean, this is a conflict that's also in many ways irrelevant for a lot of Colombians, because it isn't something that you feel in the cities here. It isn't something that impacts the economy. It's something that is very distant for most people out in very far-flung parts of the country. So this is a very different country from the one of, you know, 15 or 20 years ago that was really sort of whipsawed by conflict. I mean, this is something that a lot of people do not feel or see. Yet it does, of course, impact some people, and you really can't have a completely modern society until you really take care of a conflict like this.
Yeah.
This is the last one in Latin America.
Right, right. And so you mentioned, you know, a couple decades ago when Colombia was associated with cocaine trafficking and Medellin drug cartel. What is the situation there now in Colombia? Is it still a big cocaine exporter?
Well, Colombia is a big cocaine exporter, as is Bolivia and as is Peru. Colombia has become a far less violent country over the last 15 years. I mean, murders are just way, way down. And a lot of the big drug traffickers have been caught, have been prosecuted, have been extradited. I mean, I think that you'll always have drug trafficking because of, you know, the lure of the money and so forth. But certainly this is a country where drug trafficking does not have the you know, the overwhelming, I mean, really sort of over, you know, generating the kind of violence that you see in places like Mexico and Central America and Venezuela. So I think that there are some positive things that have happened on that front.
Juan Ferrero, South America Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. He's in Bogota. Thanks, Juan.
Thank you.
Over the past two decades, the Pentagon has spent $2.7 billion on a little-known air defense system. It's a fleet of big, white blimps meant to detect missile or drone strikes. But so far, it's really been a dud. So much so that today's Los Angeles Times calls it a zombie program, expensive, ineffective, and impossible to kill. David Willman is a reporter for the Times in Washington. He wrote the investigation out today, and he joins me now. Hi, David.
Hi, good to be with you.
Nice to have you. Well, the program is called JLENS. What does that stand for, and what is it supposed to do?
It's an acronym that is rarely spelled out, but it's the Joint Land Elevated Netted Sensor Network, something to that effect.
Okay. Well, the fact that people don't really know what it stands for, is that a metaphor for something?
I don't know. I wouldn't say that. It, actually, to be precise, it's the Joint Land Attack Cruise Missile Defense Elevated Netted Sensor System. How about that?
Okay. It sounds equally obtuse. So what is it supposed to do?
Well, it was intended to be aloft in the sky at up to 10,000 feet. This system has to operate in pairs, so you have two of these gigantic blimps, each one roughly 80 yards long. And one blimp has a very high-powered radar that scans the skies in all directions. The other blimp has a different kind of radar called X-band radar that, once it's cued to a target, can really zero in on it with high magnification. And then, and this is crucial, the intention would be for that radar to signal the data, to convey the data to offensive forces, be they rocketry on the ground or fighter jets, who can very quickly then take that data and go after and destroy an incoming cruise missile, or, it turns out, any number of other threats, including very low-flying fixed-wing aircraft, drones, you name it. So that was the original intention.
So it sounds good on paper, but it's never actually worked in 17 years?
Well, it's never actually worked as promised. That is the case. I mean, again, getting back to the original promise, the idea, the theory, the concept was to have it up there at 10,000 feet, and it could look down on low-flying targets without the obstruction of mountains, hills, the curvature of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you have ground-based radar, it's always going to be limited by the curvature of the Earth. So, you know, that had, I think, some promise to it originally, but the system has never been able to be operational, as we pointed out in great detail in today's package of articles.
Yeah, and so is that mainly a software problem?
Well, software problems have been very stubborn and persistent with this program for, you know, the bulk of the 17 years that it's been in existence. In fact, as we pointed out in today's LA Times, I mean, this system was supposed to be up and running in what was officially called an operational exercise, begun in December of 2014. They were supposed to have both blimps up, making it a functional system within 6 weeks of the launch in December. And in fact, the software problems had largely prevented the deployment of the second blimp until mid to late August. And the system, again, as had been promised, and has the prime contractor has said repeatedly, you know, is supposed to be operating for 30 days at a time, you know, with this persistent surveillance. And that just hasn't happened.
Right. And so it could have been operational the day that Douglas Hughes flew into the Capitol with that, you know, tiny airplane. And he flew some, what, 30 miles or something and landed on the lawn.
Right. This is Douglas Hughes, the postal worker from Florida,
yeah,
who wanted to make a statement about campaign finance reform, and brought his little homebrew gyrocopter, a fixed-wing miniature helicopter, I guess you might call it, and flew it at least 30 miles through some of the most highly restricted airspace in the United States, right over the National Mall and up to on the west lawn of the U.S. Capitol. And 2 weeks later, there was a hearing called at which several members of Congress were, you know, pretty upset about this, and they grilled the commander of NORAD, which is, you know, the joint force Pentagon entity that's supposed to be protecting us from threats, and said, well, wait a minute, you know, we've got this low-flying threat coming in, and you guys, what was going on? Whose job was it? And Commander Gortney, actually Admiral William Gortney, said that, you know, regrettably, on that day that the intruder came up, which would have been April 15th, tax day, JLENS was, quote, not operational, unquote. What didn't come out of that hearing, in which, you know, our research proved out, is that it hasn't been operational throughout the year. In fact, you know, it was supposed to be up and going for this operational exercise by the end of January, 1st of May, of February, right in there. And again, it wasn't until mid to late August that they even got both blimps up, and that does not that's not the same with having the radar actually integrated, mm-hmm, into the air defense network.
Yeah. So the Army is not really into this plan. JLENS, the Army brass have tried to kill it several times, I think. But the Marine Corps, I guess one general in particular, James Cartwright, is a big defender of it. Can you talk about that?
Sure. This was originally an Army program. In fact, it's still technically an Army program. But by the end of 2010, Army officials, notably four-star general Peter Corelli, who was the vice chief of the army at that time, tried to kill Jay Lenz. And as he said in interviews with me, he wanted to do so because the threats that were killing his soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq were rockets, artillery, and mortar of more of a crude variety, and Jay Lenz was not really of much use at all against those threats. I mean, cruise missiles were not killing our personnel, were not maiming our personnel in these theaters. And so General Corelli wanted to take whatever the Army would be continuing to spend on Jay Lenz and shift it, as he told me, into technologies that might have a better chance of saving the lives of our soldiers. And he was basically thwarted by the advocates of Jay Lenz, including people on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, notably one of the people who was supportive of maintaining Jay Lenz was the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the nation's number two military officer, and that is Marine General James Cartwright. And that's what happened. What we also reported in the article is it turned out, the thing that saved Jay Lenz was the shaping of this three-year operational exercise, which is supposed to be protecting Washington, D.C. and the greater National Capital Region. That was all sort of put together by the spring or so of 2011. As it turned out, they didn't get that thing, anywhere close to starting until December of 2014. But General Cartwright retired from the military by the end of August of 2011. And as we said in today's LA Times, he went on the payroll of Raytheon, the prime contractor for Jay Lenz, as of January of 2012.
So just a few months later.
Just 5 months after he retired, right. And he made $300,000 plus in his first year, and well over $800,000 by the end of 2014, according to the financial statements that I've reviewed.
Wow. Okay. So it's still alive. At least it's getting funding.
Yes, it's getting funding. This operational exercise costs about $50 million a year. And the blimps, are tethered up at Aberdeen Proving Ground, which is, roughly 60 miles northeast of Washington, D.C.
David Willman, reporter for the L.A. Times in Washington, and you can read his article on Jay Lenz there at latimes.com. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Coming up, Anheuser-Busch has bought Golden Road, a local craft brewery. We'll talk about what that means for craft beers and where to get the best ones here with our very own beer expert. Yes, we have one on staff. Her name is Jolie Myers. That's next on Press Play.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. LA's biggest craft brewery is about to get a whole lot bigger. Golden Road Brewing Company announced yesterday it has sold out to Anheuser-Busch, those guys that make Bud Light. Here's Golden Road's Meg Gill in a video announcement of the sale.
We didn't have a for sale sign in the ground. We weren't looking to sell our business. We've grown 100% a year since we've opened. But we started looking at the landscape and looking at what AB was doing with their craft brands. This is an opportunity we can't pass up.
All right. So what does this sale say about the craft beer landscape in Los Angeles? Well, joining us now is our very own Jolie Myers, who, in addition to producing this show, doing feedback every day at the end of the show, also writes about beer for Los Angeles Magazine. Hello there.
Hello. I wear many hats.
You need another theme song. Okay, so tell us about this deal. What do we know about it?
Well, the details are pretty sketchy at this point. We don't know how much they were bought for. We don't know exactly what it's going to mean for the future of Golden Road. What we do know is that Golden Road is no longer locally owned. It's owned by the big guys, Anheuser-Busch. Anheuser-Busch is owned by AB InBev, which is the multinational, ginormous beer company that makes Bud Light, as we said.
So what does this mean? Does Golden Road then become like Bud Light, tasting-wise?
Well, The taste of Golden Road beers is another story in itself. But what's generally happened when these big, giant multinational beer companies come in and pick up a craft brewery, they basically leave the beer alone. They leave it in local control for the most part. The day-to-day operations stay with the original head brewers and the people who started these breweries. What actually happens, though, is that the distribution reach becomes much larger for a company like Golden Road. You get access to basically anywhere that Bud is. You will likely be able to find a Golden Road in the near future. So it's a big deal.
That's a big deal. Okay. Right. So, but there are other craft breweries here in Los Angeles, but Golden Road is the biggest?
Golden Road is by far the biggest. They make 40,000 barrels of beer a year. Most other craft breweries here are making a tiny fraction of that. You can get Golden Road beer in over 4,000 retail locations. So basically, you can throw a rock and hit a Golden Road beer in Los Angeles at this point. That is not the case with most local craft breweries.
Okay, so what are they saying about this? What are the enthusiasts, the experts, the craft beerists, what do you call them?
Baristas? People say beer nerds.
Beer nerds?
Beer nerds, probably.
Okay, what are they saying about this?
The craft beer enthusiasts in Los Angeles, the reaction to this deal has been various shades of, no! And it's kind of a funny thing.
But because, why? Because you just said the beer's not going to change.
Right, right. And I guess that's part of it. But like a lot of things, this is an emotional reaction rather than looking at the spreadsheets and all that. And in the craft beer world, emotion is a big deal. People really identify with these tiny brands. They're locally brewed. It's people who have toiled for years in their garages as home brewers, and then they scraped up enough money to open up a tiny brewery, and then the beers get better and the word spreads, and then there's a certain amount of blue collar success that comes with this. It's the little guy.
Yeah.
And you know, when a craft brewery that people identify with is bought by AB InBev, that messes with their identity as a beer nerd. So it's kind of like if Applebee's came in and bought Father's Office, even if they didn't mess with the menu at all, that would really freak people out. So it's this funny thing where in most industries, if you're a startup and Microsoft comes sniffing around and wants to buy your company, great. You got a bunch of millionaires out of that. There's more access to your app or whatever it is. Craft beer, that is not how things work.
But craft beers here in LA, this is really new, right? Just in the last 5 years, has it become a thing?
Right. Yes, absolutely. In five years.
And it's exploding, right?
That is true. Craft beer is exploding in Los Angeles. And that time frame of 5 years is pretty much accurate. Eagle Rock Brewing out in Glassell Park, they were the very first craft brewery to open within the city limits of Los Angeles. That was 2009. Since then, there's been an explosion. A recent look at who's applying for brewing licenses in the county of Los Angeles finds that half of the brewing licenses have been issued in the last 2 years, basically since craft brewing became a thing in this area.
Wow.
So it's exploding. It's exponential growth.
And it's exploding nationwide. Hence the interest from Anheuser-Busch.
That's absolutely correct. So basically what you're seeing is in 2014, 11% of the beer consumed in America was craft beer. You know, if you look at those numbers 15 years ago, craft beer wasn't even a thing, 0%. And so what you're seeing is, again, an exponential rise in craft beer drinking. And so these big multinational companies are saying, well, if you can't beat them, buy them. And that's exactly what's happening.
Let me ask you a really basic question. What is a craft beer?
So the governing body of craft beer in America defines craft beer as such. Basically, you have to be small. You have to not be owned by a giant multinational corporation. More than 1/4 of your company cannot be owned by a big company. So, for instance, Golden Road can't call itself craft anymore because it's owned by one of these big multinational companies. Some of the other defining characteristics of craft beer are that you have to use traditional ingredients like barley, like hops, like water, like yeast. That's what makes a craft beer. There are some other little kind of small details on that, but there's actually real like rules about what makes a craft beer. Absolutely. And people take those very seriously. I mean, there's bars in Los Angeles that pull beers that are no longer craft. So for instance, Golden Road, there's certain beer bars in Los Angeles that will no longer serve them because they are no longer a craft company.
Interesting. Okay, so now let's get to your recommendations. put on your critic's hat, because I know you drink a lot of beer for your job, your other job. What do you like in the craft beer scene?
Can we talk local?
Of course.
Let's talk local.
Yes.
Let's do it. Okay, so actually sort of in the neighborhood of Golden Road, you have Eagle Rock Brewing, which we talked about earlier, that is making some really, really solid, clean beers, things like, you know, IPAs, wit beers, that kind of thing. They're starting to experiment with sour beers, which is exciting. One of my favorite breweries in Los Angeles right now is something called Highland Park Brewing. And it is tiny. It is basically brewing in the storeroom of a place called the Hermosillo in Highland Park.
On York.
On York.
Uh-huh.
It's a little, basically you can call it a brew pub. They are making some of the most exciting experimental beers in Los Angeles right now. They're basically gathering greens from the backyard to throw into the mash. They're making some of the most lip puckering-ist sour beers in the area. I am a sour beer evangelist, so I'll always shout those out. So Highland Park Brewery is fabulous. Monkish down in Torrance makes really, really amazing Belgian beers. So if you're into that world, Monkish in Torrance is fun. And the last one I'll shout out is a recent addition in LA. It's a brewery called Three Weavers Brewing Company, and they make some of my favorite IPAs. So, you know, if you like the hoppy stuff, it's female owned and operated, which is also exciting in the craft beer world, and they're making some of the most fabulous beers that I've had in the last year. So Three Weavers is in Inglewood, so you can visit their tap room in Inglewood. They just started bottling, so in the finer beer establishments in the area, you'll be able to pick up a bottle of Three Weavers, and you can also find them on tap in the better beer bars in the area.
Well, okay. Thank you for that very informative piece of reporting and criticism.
Well, of course. Anytime, Madeline.
Yeah, anytime. In fact, I'll see you in a few minutes from now for the feedback.
That's right. Many hats indeed.
Jolie Myers, Press Play's managing producer and Los Angeles Magazine's beer blogger. Okay, let's hear from you now. Do you have a favorite craft beer or favorite brew pub in LA? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESSPLAY, or you can weigh in on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, Warren Jeffs is in prison for the rest of his life, but he still manages to control thousands of followers in the FLDS, the polygamous offshoot of the Mormon Church. John Krakauer says Jeffs still runs a multi-million dollar operation that trades on child labor and child marriage.
The children were literally released back to their abusers. They were on that ranch specifically to be raised up and used as breeders.
The new documentary, Prophets Pray, after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In 2008, authorities raided the compound of the Fundamentalist Church of the Latter-day Saints, a polygamous, unsanctioned offshoot of the Mormon Church.
Developing story in Texas tonight, where a raid is underway at the secret polygamous compound run by the FLDS Church, whose leader, Warren Jeffs, is now in prison. Now, backed up with an armored personnel carrier and our SWAT team for a big show of force, authorities moved in last night. Dozens of girls have been removed from the compound, we're told. A local TV station is reporting that many of the girls are pregnant.
The media descended on the Yearning for Zion Ranch in Texas and watched as more than 400 children were bussed out by Child Protective Services. Well, since then, six FLDS members have been convicted of various crimes, and that includes the self-appointed prophet of the sect, Warren Jeffs.
For your own children's sake, raise them up as calves in the stall, protected from evil influences.
Jeffs is serving life plus 20 years for two felony counts of child sexual assault. But according to a new documentary, he still runs the FLDS from prison, and the church still has 10,000 members. Amy Berg is the director of Prophets Pray. It's about Warren Jeffs and the FLDS. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And she joined forces to make the movie with John Krakauer, author of the book Under the Banner of Heaven. It's about this sect. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
And also here in the studio, Sam Brower, private investigator, and the movie is based on his book, Prophets Pray. Welcome to you, Sam.
Thanks so much.
Well, thanks all of you for coming in. And Amy, let's begin with you. Warren's father, Rulon, he was the founder of this sect. And when he died, Warren was able to take over.
Well, it was before he died. He actually had a stroke about 5 years before he died. And Warren began to accumulate more and more power with his father alive. He was able to manipulate all of the followers into believing that he was in charge. He was planning this out as in those 5 years after his father had the stroke, he started marrying younger wives and they just kept getting younger and younger. But I mean, I think you see that this is a madman running this operation.
The prophet before Rulon, Warren's dad, was a guy named Leroy Johnson, Uncle Roy. And everyone now speaks of him as this benevolent, wonderful guy. He wasn't. But then Rulon came along, and they all say how great Uncle Roy was and how terrible Rulon was. And now that Warren is the prophet, they go, oh, man, I wish we were back with Uncle Rulon, you know, because each one is worse. Warren has taken it by an order of magnitude. I mean, they always, young girls were always married to old, creepy old guys. But Warren took it to, you know, now it wasn't 16-year-olds, it was 13 and 12-year-olds and 11-year-olds.
And he himself.
Oh, he himself. I mean, you know, he himself married these young girls, and there's all these power plays where I'll marry you three of these daughters. You know, this lieutenant, I want him to be loyal, so I'll give him three of my daughters and he'll give me three of his. That was going on all the time.
So how is this not seen as just a pedophile ring?
That's exactly what it is.
Masquerading as a religion.
That's exactly what it is. It's an organized crime syndicate specializing in child abuse, human trafficking. They traffic across interstate and international boundaries to Mexico and Canada. And you have one main crime, like child abuse, and then you have to find like three or four predicate acts. Well, there are dozens of them, human trafficking, fraud, tax fraud, welfare fraud, kidnapping, extortion. And so it was an easy RICO suit, you know. There's nothing religious about it, you know.
Right.
It's just a crime organization. No religion has all their leaders doing time in Texas prisons.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the finances and how Warren Jeffs was able to become so wealthy and just how he set up the financial aspect of this sect.
People used to tithe exorbitant amounts and they'd have to do work days on Saturdays where they do work. Warren changed it into you tithe, but now you give me, you know, 50% of your paycheck. So they set up these shell corporations or actual corporations by faithful who get government contracts. And they get them because they have slave labor, literally. They hire underage children, boys as young as 12 and 14, driving big rigs cross-country, driving heavy equipment. And all these boys, they're paid on paper, but then they sign their checks over and they go back to the church. So these FLDS companies underbid other contractors, get contracts that are supposed to be regulated by Davis-Bacon laws about, you know, union wages. They can underbid anybody. And they're huge contracts.
And what are they providing? What is this?
There's highways, gas pipelines, Walmarts, lighting for all the casino. Huge. They're really good at construction. They
bring all the kids in to do
And they work on godly hours. Yeah. Literally, when they're building the temple, the boys would be working 20 hours a day, praying 2 hours and sleeping 2 hours. And so there's all that. There's incredible amount of fraud. Defrauding the government is your duty as a member of this church. They call it bleeding the beast. They're really good at, if a guy has a dozen wives, only the first one is legally married. The other 11, each of whom might have 8 to 12 kids, will then apply for welfare and child support and food stamps. They're really good at getting government grants. There's a nice airport paid for by the federal government in Short Creek. They have Homeland Security grants that paid for all these cameras and all the phone taps, you know, from 9/11. They know it's just they're brilliant at defrauding the government.
So several of the scenes in your documentary are quite shocking in that they portray this compound that has this incredible amount of surveillance that when you're driving around in the truck, you see cameras everywhere and they know immediately when you've come into town that you're there.
They know before. 10 minutes outside of town that you're coming, and they have cameras mounted on people's homes, facing towards the street, on telephone poles. They just put them wherever they need the cameras.
So, but what are they trying to see or prevent or catch, or why so much surveillance?
They're paranoid, you know, and Warren keeps the people just scared to death. The government's coming at any time to raid them. The end of the world is coming. You know, I get the impression that the cameras are there just as much or maybe more to watch the people there to make sure that they're towing the line as it is to watch strangers coming into town. It's a way of keeping the people afraid, paranoid, in fear of the outside world, the government, and then of also watching, you know, when people like me come in or Amy with cameras or, you know, something like that, they can have a heads up, and they send out their church security, which we call the God Squad, to harass people. And I mean, they try and pull you off the road. They'll get in front of you and spray you with gravel, spin their tires and spray you with gravel. I've placed several windshields and
throwing, you know, water bottles while we're filming, or throwing rocks at the camera crew. I mean, it was
boxing you in.
Yeah.
And there's this foundation. I mean, Warren is smart. In 1953, the state of Arizona had a huge raid. Dozens of state police. They basically arrested all the men in town, took all the women and children. The children were taken away. And it was a tactical blunder, and there was this huge backlash. I mean, they were polygamists. They were breaking the law. This is Short Creek, the same town, you know, the ancestors of Warren. And, you know, it just was a mistake. All the men were returned. And from then on, the 53 raid has been this rallying cry. And Warren Jeffs uses that to increase this paranoia, which he uses to increase his loyalty.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with John Krakauer and Sam Brower about Warren Jeffs and the Fundamentalist Church of the Latter-day Saints. Both men have investigated the church, and they've written books about it, and they've joined forces with Amy Berg on a new documentary. It's called Prophets Pray. In 2008, the church made headlines when authorities raided their compound in Texas. Well, I think what was shocking from what I remember from that news, those news clips of those children being taken out of the compound and loaded onto those buses, and then finding out that they had to be returned back to the compound. And I think all of us who watched that from the outside were flummoxed. How could that have happened, that these children were then returned back into this sect, which, you know, had been accused of multiple counts of child endangerment, child rape?
Right. I mean, these guys were there at the time I was documenting John and Sam after the fact, but it seemed to be like it was the big letdown. And the idea that these kids don't even have birth certificates. They were returned to people that weren't their parents, and it just stopped right there. When we were in Texas, we did try to speak with the Child Protective Services office, and it's not something that they wanted to talk about. But the raid offered this trial, and so it turned into something good. But there are still all the children, and that's what everyone's the most worried about.
There was literally a truckload, a semi-load of evidence that came out, which was my motivation to write the book, to try and get some of that information out there. But the children were literally released back to their abusers. They were on that ranch specifically to be raised up and used as breeders. Only the most righteous could go there. And when CPS went there, they were just beside themselves. They thought they were going to find a few, you know, one, two children, but they kept finding more and
hundreds,
more.
Yeah.
And they even released some of the girls that were like 16 years old that gave birth while they were still in protective custody. And they released them to Canadian citizens that took them immediately back to Canada. There's 463 children that nobody even knows where they're at today. It's really sad because, I mean, nothing like that had ever happened before in the history of the country. Never has there been a CPS seizure of children that's that huge. And they just didn't know how to act. You know, what do we do now? There's statutory requirements. We have to have, you know, hearings and trials on certain dates, and all these things have to happen statutorily. And they didn't know how to handle that many children. And so they had attorneys coming from everywhere, all over the state, hundreds of attorneys coming in to try and represent them. In the first month, it cost over $13 million for the state of Texas.
Wow.
So when the Supreme Court said, no, you have to treat these children individually, you can't do these hearings as a group, CPS just seized that opportunity and said, okay, well, we're just going to return.
And they just folded and they didn't bother to fight.
If it had been 10 kids or 20, they would have been taken to foster care and their abusers would have been prosecuted. But because there was 400, they were turned back. The horrible irony of that, because there were so many of them, none of them could be saved.
So we who were following this in the media when Warren Jeffs was sentenced to life plus in prison, we thought, well, that's the end of that.
Right.
That's the end of this FLDS. But no, it's going just as strong as ever.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't believe it when these guys told me that he was running this empire from prison. I heard his prophecies. You know, you hear his voice and you think, how is this working? It doesn't make any sense. He's monotone and he doesn't have any charisma like past cult leaders that we know about. But the more you get into it, you find out how much power he has. And the more power he has, more power in prison than if he was on the outside, because all of his followers think that they are responsible for him being there. So they continue to believe this whole religious persecution.
So he's like a martyr.
He's a martyr. Yes, he's a martyr. I mean, they've built cells that simulate his prison cell so that they're reminded on a daily basis of their leader in prison.
And they're to blame.
Their
responsibility for not being righteous enough and not praying hard enough, not giving enough money to him. It's your fault that I'm here is the message every day, every moment of every day.
You know, it's just another thing that Warren can use to make their lives miserable and see how much he can get away with.
And he can do it all from his prison cell. Through these communications.
And corrupt lawyers and his family visits with his brother and his
He gets phone calls. He gets 240 minutes of phone calls.
They speak in code.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you all so much for coming in and sharing. It seems just like just a fraction of this story. Really interesting.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That's Amy Berg, director of the new documentary Prophets Pray. It's about the FLDS and its leader, Warren Jeffs. John Krakauer and Sam Brower have written books about the church and are featured in the film. And Prophets Pray opens this Friday at the Arclight Hollywood. Also, you can see it next month on Showtime. Coming up on the program, Shani Jardin is here to talk about web stuff, including the dreaded Waze left turn. That's next on Press Play.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Could Volkswagen's massive software cheat have been avoided if its car software was open source? Copyright activists say yes, and that more software transparency would make cars safer, not just for the environment, but from malicious hackers as well. Well, one car adjacent company that could maybe stand a little hacking is Waze. The crowdsourced directions app is under fire for the infamous Waze left turn. And that's when Waze advises you that the best way to get to work or wherever is to cut across six lanes of traffic to make a supposedly convenient left turn. Well, joining me to discuss this and all things web related is Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. I have to admit, I'd made quite a few Waze lefts in my time.
I have made many, and many all the way throughs.
There you
not
go.
Just the lefts, but all the way through six lanes of traffic, and just thanked my lucky stars that I was.
Yeah, you know, I just thought in health conscious LA, the Waze left is now out of fashion.
So this Waze left turn, I mean, this, as we now have discovered, is the bane of many a driver. And what are they doing to try to fix this?
It's not clear because it is proprietary software, which we're going to get to in another segment in a moment. But there are things that they can programmatically do to say, if you're a piece of software, this looks like a very logical thing to do. Out in the real world, not so much.
Yeah. So they could actually say, look, one street over, there's a traffic light.
That's right.
Just take that and you'll still get there on time.
Yes. I mean, in LA, there are no guarantees, but there are just a lot of things about Waze that I personally feel are such bad UI that they're dangerous. So they have a long way to go with usability. I think that this really highlights how good design in apps that we're going to be using in our cars while those flying hunks of death metal are in motion, that design better be good or lives are at stake. And that dreaded left-hand turn is just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, the ways. I love ways. Of the ways.
I love ways. I hate ways. This is basically my relationship with all technology. Love, yeah. Hate,
okay,
complain. Well, love, hate, complain.
Let's continue that with VW and the software that is getting them into big, big trouble.
What a story!
It's a crazy story. It just gets more internecine and more interesting as it goes on.
Right.
But so there's this argument now that if their software, this is the defeat device that is actually programmed into the car to make it look like it's got better emissions when it's being tested than when it's on the open road. And there's an argument now that that software should be open source. What do you think?
There was this great New York Times piece today in which Columbia University law professor Ibn Moglen, he says proprietary software, and that's software that you or I can't look at because it belongs to Volkswagen, proprietary software is an unsafe building material. You can't inspect it. The idea is that, look, software is in everything from medical devices, airplanes, but so much of it is proprietary, meaning it belongs to the company that owns the IP, owns the copyright, owns the trademark, owns the patent, and we can't inspect it. So it's
so we have to rely on the company's
own trust us.
Goodwill.
Trust us. We're Volkswagen.
But do you think that people, if it had been open, that white hat hackers could have gotten in there and said, "Hey, there's a problem here," earlier?
And that is basically what happened. This team of researchers were actually looking at Volkswagen software, looking at the emission system, thinking that it was going to be such a stellar example, because Volkswagen has to date been a very responsible company in many of these areas that have to do with pollution, that have to do with driver safety. They're a much loved brand. And it was amazing that the way they were outed, wasn't by nefarious hackers, wasn't even by, nefarious tree-hugging environmentalists. It was by people who are on their side. So yes, the idea is that if the code is open and inspectable, people who have interests that are different than the profit-seeking interest of the manufacturer, they have a chance to look at that and say, oh, hey, people could die because of this. Transparency is a good thing in society.
Although,
it's a good thing in code.
Yeah, I agree. But then there are these fears that it could open it up to the black hat hackers, people who want to, open these software codes to abuse the car, to make it less environmentally friendly because it would improve performance, for instance, or something more malicious.
Here's a dirty little secret. The malicious people are going to get in there anyway. It's like locks on your luggage. They keep the good people out. They keep the honest people out.
Yeah. All right. So Heather Armstrong, a.k.a. Deuce, the first or one of the biggest first mommy bloggers, has decided to call it quits on her blog. Really? No more Deuce?
The news that Deuce was shutting down her mommy blog, which is the mommy blog. Basically, she chronicles every aspect of being a mom and her struggles with depression and her struggles with marriage. Her marriage ended, I think she even says, in part because of the pressures of running this we live in public sort of lifestyle.
I mean, she quit her job. He quit his job.
Yeah.
This was a full-time thing.
And it was a beautiful experiment. So the fact that she's quitting the mommy blogging gig isn't actually new. What was new was today she came out and said, you know why I really did this? Because of the torturous, invasive pressure of the web advertisers who sponsored what I was doing. It really strikes a chord with a lot of us who are working in online media, because any of us who've had contact with web advertising know that things are getting really scary out there, and the sponsors and the ad networks that are left and that are strong know that they can demand increasingly invasive things from sort of personality-driven bloggers like Heather. But also here we are in LA with lots and lots of individual YouTube stars and Instagram stars and people who become famous from blogging about the entertainment industry. Good luck monetizing that, because advertisers know that they have you over a barrel.
So it's not just putting their ad up, their static ad, or maybe she actually had to participate in the product, actually write about it as a blog post.
Yeah, because banner advertising, display advertising is... it's dying. With Apple's delivery of iOS 9, that blocks ads by default. So the sorts of companies that facilitate what's called sponsored content or branded content, like what Heather Armstrong was doing, they're going to get more aggressive. You know, hey, hold your baby up to the camera and have its first words be how wonderful this cereal is. That didn't actually happen. I'm just making it up, but actually probably did.
So she basically said, I couldn't do this anymore because it was taking over my children's life and my life.
And they wanted my kids on camera. They wanted my kids on the blog. It was wild. You know, you could look at her and say, yeah, well, she opened the door. But this is a real turning point in online publishing. And it's the turning point at which we have to choose whether we're going to control our creative output and our own destiny, or whether we're just kind of there to churn page views for advertisers who really don't care about our families or our businesses or why we got into this in the first place. So, Heather Armstrong, I feel your pain, and it's a very interesting time.
Well, Shani Jardin, I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Brave, not so brave new future, I guess.
It's brave if we want it to be,
there
Madeline.
You go. All right. Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Well, as promised, you're back.
I'm back.
Jolie Myers.
But I spent so much time talking about beer earlier in the show that there's no time for feedback today. But we do want to hear about your favorite local craft beer.
Definitely.
Tweet
do.
Us, KCRW Press Play. We are here for you.
Okay. Thank you. Short and sweet.
You're so
welcome. All names up next in a few seconds from now. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.